Our next speaker will be talking to us about procedural risks of bleeding and when and how to bridge, a question I think we all ask ourselves on a pretty frequent basis. Dr. Brown recently left Lancaster Regional Medical Center to head up the cardiovascular and thoracic surgery program at Petersburg, Virginia, and is a reserve thoracic surgeon consultant to the Army Surgeon General and a reserve staff surgeon for the Division of Thoracic Surgery at Tripler Army Medical Center. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I have no financial disclosures with any commercial interest pertaining to the content of this talk. We're going to have a little bit of overlap here with the different speakers, but hopefully the overlap are the important items that we want to drive home today. When we talk about the risks of surgery in the anticoagulated patient, it's really a no-win situation. We've got risks of thrombosis from stopping the anticoagulation. We've got risks of bleeding from being over anticoagulated with two agents while bridging, if one chooses to bridge. We have the risk of bleeding from surgery if the patient is still anticoagulated when you operate. The risk of thrombosis post-op from not being anticoagulated, the risks of being hypercoagulable or auto-anticoagulated in the post-operative state, the risk of bleeding from bridging from heparin back to warfarin if one is going to bridge after surgery, and the risk of bleeding from just being anticoagulated in general in the immediate post-operative state. So we have all of these different competing interests going against each other in the patient. When we look at the risks of stopping chronic anticoagulants, the risk of thrombosis from stopping them for a few days is very low. The thromboembolic risk stratified into three groups. High risk is greater than 10% per year, and that's actually only 0.027% per day. And the low risk is less than 5% risk of thrombosis per year, and that's only less than 0.013% per day. And if one figured you were off of it for 10 days surrounding, let's say, a colon resection, that's only a 0.13% thrombosis risk. Again, we're not talking about somebody that has an acute problem that we're treating. So since the risk of thrombosis from stopping chronic anticoagulants for a very few days is very low, why worry about it at all? Why just not go ahead and do it? We do many other things with a risk that's much higher than that. The problem is that although the risk of thrombosis or thromboembolism is very low, the case fatality rate is quite high. If you develop a thrombosis of a mechanical heart valve, the death rate is 17.5%. From a DVT, it's 5 to 10% postoperatively under these circumstances, and the death rate from a stroke under these circumstances is as high as 37%. So although the rates of stopping and having a problem are minimal, the complications occur, they're generally major. And although we shouldn't be making medical decisions because of medical legal attorney issues, I can say that when you stop anticoagulants for elective surgery without bridging, without crossing all the I's and dotting all the T's, it generally results in a medical legal lawsuit. As you, the surgeon, stop something somebody else thought was very necessary. It would seem obvious that patients that are anticoagulated, although at a low risk of having a problem, should be bridged with some other acute agent that can be immediately stopped prior to surgery and give them the lowest overall risk of thrombosis and medical legal exposure, but that's not really necessarily the case. Patients on anticoagulation have increased risk of bleeding. Patients being bridged from one form of anticoagulation have an even higher risk of bleeding in the bridging period, secondary to overlapping of different mechanisms of anticoagulation and not being really sure where you are with one when you start the bridging to the other. I digress here for a minute. We have a score called the Hasbled score, and you're awarded 1 point for each of those items that you see on the chart there. I've listed those items again at the top you can look at, but a score greater than or equal to 3 correlates with an increased risk of bleeding while on oral anticoagulation of about 6%, as well as increased risk of bleeding when being bridged with some other agent prior to pending elective surgery. So in certain patients, there's an increased risk of bleeding in the bridged patient. Overlap of agents can be the problem. I'm going to shift gears here for a minute. What's the other side of the coin, the risk of not stopping chronic anticoagulation? Well, i.e., what's the increased risk of bleeding from surgery while on anticoagulants? Well, it depends on many things. It depends on the primary risk of bleeding from the procedure in general, complications that might occur. how high the level of anticoagulation is prior to surgery, what anticoagulants they're on, and if they can be reversed if need be, and the patient's has blood score. Can we put a number on the increased risk of bleeding? Not really. We all know there's an increased risk, but we really don't know how much the increased risk is. But we have a little bit of data from coronary artery bypass grafting patients. As many of you know, it was very in vogue to never operate on any of these patients, and we would stop the aspirin for 10 days and do bleeding time tests on them every single day for 10 days 30 years ago. And then when Plavix came around, we wanted to stop it on everybody, and then some data came out that said you didn't need to, so just go ahead and operate on Plavix. But what we do know is if you operate on Plavix, you increase the take-back rate for bleeding from 1 to 3% to 10 to 30%, and blood utilization goes up threefold, although the mortality doesn't go up all that much. I will say there are some studies that show no difference, but in general, the bleeding rate is much higher. So I think we can all agree that there is some increased risk of bleeding in the anticoagulated patient. We just don't have a lot of studies that show exactly what it is. We need to be even more concerned of the minimally invasive procedures where we can't necessarily get to the bleeding to fix it if it occurs and might require you to open, as well as in the maximally invasive procedures such as cardiac surgery or liver transplantation where excessive bleeding might be fatal and we just can't get a handle on it. So I think we can suffice it to say that we should not be operating on the auto or the anticoagulated patient if it can be helped. One additional point, though, however, the risk of bleeding when operating on the anticoagulated patient is relatively high. The risk of major morbidity and mortality is lower than complications from thrombosis. And I always remember a quote when I was a general surgery resident on the vascular surgery rotation that they would prefer to drain hematoma than declot a graft. And I think that serves to emphasize that when you have thrombosis, it's not so easy to fix that problem, and often it can't be. But if you have bleeding, we have lots of ways to hopefully fix that. So a little bit of summary before we go on to part two. Risk of thrombosis from stopping chronic anticoagulation is very low, but it's not zero. The risk of death from that thrombosis is high. There's increased risk of bleeding and thrombosis during the bridging period, but we really don't know how much. The risk of bleeding on the anticoagulated patient is high, but the risk of death from that is relatively low. It's a given we need to stop blood thinners prior to surgery and ideally not have too much on board when we operate. So the next question that we want to ask is to bridge or not to bridge. We as surgeons know we need to stop it, but can we just stop it or do we need to bridge them to some other agent? One of the problems is we know who bleeds, but we really don't know how many don't bleed or don't thrombose. There are very few blinded, randomized, controlled studies to support bridging. There probably never will be many more, but we do have a little bit of data. In 2015, it was shown that the incidence of arterial thromboembolism in patients was the same whether they were bridged with heparin or just got placebo. However, the bleeding rate was 3.2% versus 1.3% in the bridged group. This was a group of patients that were generally all low-risk CHADS-2 score patients, but it showed that there was no real benefit to bridging these patients. High-quality data regarding the utility of bridging remains limited, but in general, it is recommended only for patients who have high perioperative VTE risk if anticoagulation is discontinued. So that begs the next question, who's at low risk and who's at high risk of thrombosis off of anticoagulation? If I digress for a minute, we have several scores that we look at. There's the CHADS-2 score for AFib. We get 1 point for each of those items and two for the last one. If you have a score of zero, you're at low risk, 1 to 2 moderate risk, and greater than 3 or 3 high risk of thrombosis while you're on AFib. Some have recommended the CHADS-2 VAS score that was talked about earlier over the CHADS-2 score, but they're relatively similar. And I think everybody agrees all with a score of 3 should be anticoagulated. However, a CHADS-2 0 score is not necessarily low risk. 10% of patients with atrial fibrillation in a CHADS-2 score of 0 getting a cardioversion were found to have atrial thrombosis on the transesophageal echocardiogram. So the data isn't entirely clear. So who is at low risk of thrombosis where bridging is not recommended from warfarin to heparin? Patients with non-valvular AFib with a low CHAD score. If we want to quibble about 3 or 4, we have multiple papers showing different items, but basically let's just call it a low CHAD score of less than 3 to 4. And somebody with a bileaflet aortic valve. And a bileaflet aortic valve these days is a St. Jude valve or a Carbomedix valve. The tilting disc valves and the ball and cage valves are really of historical interest, but you still will see patients that have those, but they're not really placed anymore. But that's it. Essentially, everybody else who doesn't have non-valvular, low CHAD score AFib, and who doesn't have a bileaflet aortic valve is considered at high risk for thrombosis without being bridged. And who are those high-risk patients, or higher-risk patients, if you want to call it that? Anybody with a mechanical mitral valve, anybody with a non-bileaflet valve, anybody with 2 mechanical valves, anybody with valvular-induced AFib, a high CHAD score or a VAS score, a prior stroke or TIA from a valve or intracardiac thrombus, an active DVT or a VTE within the last 3 months, or a VTE that has occurred while still on anticoagulation. So how do we bridge these patients? Well, it depends what you come to us on. You may come to us on warfarin. You may come to us on the novel or direct oral anticoagulants. You may come to us on antiplatelet therapy that's therapeutic, i.e. have a drug-eluting stent, or come to us on antiplatelet therapy that's prophylactic. You're on aspirin because you're an adult male. How do we bridge these folks? Hold warfarin for 5 days prior to the procedure. Here's what gets a little sticky. When the INR is less than the therapeutic range for that condition, start low molecular rate heparin. There's a lot of thought out there that, well, when the INR is less than 2 or less than 1.6, you'll do it, but you really want to do it when it's less than whatever therapeutic range you've determined for that condition. So if you're keeping that patient between an INR of 3.5 and 4.5, you need to start low molecular rate heparin at 3.5. If you're keeping that patient between 2 and 3, then you should start low molecular rate heparin when they get less than 2. The problem is that when we stop people's Coumadin outside the hospital, nobody's checking their INR on a daily basis to see when they fall below the therapeutic range and start low molecular weight heparin. Most people really just start winging it and either starting it the same day, which gives you increased risk of bleeding, or they're starting it maybe halfway through, or they're starting it on day 4. So trying to get good data from these patients who don't have a daily INR to say when you should start the low molecular weight heparin, we really don't have good data on that. But suffice it to say that if you were going to check it every day, that's what you should do. Hold it the day prior to surgery. And if they show up in the morning of surgery and the INR is elevated, you can give 1.5 milligrams of vitamin K, which will usually get them down pretty shortly. When we look at the other agents, the first novel agent was developed in 2010, and it novel referred to mechanism of action, not the fact that it was a new agent. And although the N initially stood for novel, according to the CHEST guidelines, which seem to be the keeper of all of this data, but now it means non-vitamin K anticoagulants. I will digress for a minute and say the CHEST guidelines are great. They come out every year. It's hundreds of pages long and a supplement to the CHEST journal. However, whenever it gets down to talking about surgery, it usually references check with the surgeon, up to the surgeon's discretion, whatever the surgeon wants to do, and the guidelines kind of fall apart a little bit when we get to talking about surgery, which is interesting because we're all surgeons and that's what we want to know. One last comment. There was a recommendation in 2015 of changing the novel oral anticoagulants to direct oral anticoagulants. The vote was held and it edged it out by 1% because people were concerned that novel NOAC might be construed as no oral anticoagulant and there might be problems with that down the road. There are a couple other names for these novel agents there that I've listed over at the bottom. However, they're sort of falling out of favor and going away. So what do we need to do with bridging the novel agents? And we're going to switch gears here. When we were talking about patients on Coumadin, we're deciding if they're at low risk or high risk of thrombosis and determining whether to bridge or not. For the novel agents, bridging is not required. But what is required is determining how long to hold them, and that's based on whether they are high or low risk of bleeding and whether they have renal failure or not. Why is bridging not needed in the direct agents? This could be an entire talk, but basically their mechanism of action is such that it's quite predictable after you've held them for the times we're going to talk about. There seems to be enough activity to prevent thrombosis, but not very much activity to cause bleeding. So we don't bridge the novel agents. So just backtracking here for a minute, for warfarin, we're going to hold it for 5 days. When the INR is less than the therapeutic range for that condition, start low molecular weight heparin 24 hours prior to surgery and then stop it. If they're in the hospital and you want to put them on IV heparin, that's fine too, but you don't really need to do that. For the direct oral agents, if they're at low risk of bleeding, you hold it 1 day prior to surgery. If they're at low risk of bleeding but have renal dysfunction, hold it for 2 days. If they're at high risk of bleeding, hold it for 2 days. And if they're at high risk of bleeding with renal dysfunction, hold it for 4 days prior to surgery. And I think those are really the key points that will serve you well. For antiplatelet agents, as mentioned before, we'd like to defer anything, if at all possible, 14 days after an angioplasty, 30 days after a bare metal stent, and 1 day after a drug, or 1 year after a drug-eluting stent. And that's because the drug is prothrombotic, and in a year, it's basically gone. Although in my experience with working with cardiologists, they are starting to bend the rules a little bit and okay to stop it without doing something else at 9 months. But bottom line is it should be continued for a year. A word to the wise at the bottom. If you don't check with the patient's cardiologist and they have a drug-eluting stent and you do something with stopping or starting, it's going to be your fault regardless of what happens, even if you did the right thing. So get cardiology involved if they have a drug-eluting stent. If you can't defer surgery after angioplasty or a bare metal stent, continue aspirin if they're at low risk of bleeding. Stop both agents, aspirin and Plavix, if they're on a second agent at high risk of bleeding. If you can't defer surgery in a patient with a drug-eluting stent, continue dual antiplatelet therapy if at low risk of bleeding. Continue aspirin only and stop the secondary agent if they're at high risk for bleeding, and start the secondary agent as soon as possible. Occasionally this condition comes up. Usually it's applying only to the cardiothoracic surgeons. If one just had a drug-eluting stent placed in the hospital, needs surgery in 1 to 2 days, can't have it sooner for whatever reason, can't have it later, is at high risk of stent thrombosis and a high risk of bleeding, a lot of times the cardiologist will leave the patients on Riopro, which is an IV antiplatelet agent, stop it 6 hours prior to surgery. The problem is that agent lasts for 48 hours, can still be present up to 15 days. There is no reversal except for treatment with platelets. You want to tread carefully if you're operating on a patient that's been on Riopro. It might be the best thing in the world for their stent, but it's not going to be the best thing for your bleeding problems after surgery. And nobody really knows, if you're pounding these patients with platelets after surgery, how much more that's going to increase the risk of thrombosis from the drug-eluting stent. The last category is how to bridge the prophylactic antiplatelet agent patients. These are the patients that are on for secondary prevention with no active issues. They had a bare metal stent placed and they're 6 weeks out. They're a year out on the drug-eluting stent and they're just on aspirin, or they're on it because they have carotid disease, a prior stroke, MI prevention. There's no benefit to continuing, and there is increased risk of bleeding if one does not stop those. So in general, we recommend stopping aspirin and Plavix 5 to 7 days prior to surgery if they're at low risk of bleeding, 7 to 10 days if they're at higher risk of bleeding prior to surgery. And was mentioned in the prior talk, and although I didn't put that in here, if you're on aspirin therapy or dual therapy because of a remote PCI, there does seem to be some benefit to continuing those drugs to prevent myocardial infarction in the perioperative period. Exactly what the definition of remote is. Do we need to treat the patient that had it at 18 months the same as the one that had it 14 years ago? Obviously, the longer ago you had it, probably the less likely it is that you need to stay on that. But it really depends on what your current coronary condition is, and you may not know that without a recent cardiac cath. One last comment on ortho patients: giving heparin or low molecular weight products prior to surgery or during the procedure to actively try and prevent another onset of post-op DVT is a whole other ball of wax, and we really didn't delve into actively trying to prevent problems in patients that are just at high risk based upon their procedures. So in conclusion, stopping anticoagulation in all patients except trivial procedures with low risk of bleeding or low risk of morbidity and mortality from bleeding is appropriate. Bridge all patients at high risk of thrombosis or emboli on Coumadin with IV heparin or sub-Q low molecular weight heparin. You stop, but you don't need to bridge direct oral anticoagulant patients, and their treatment is based upon the risk of bleeding and whether they have renal failure or not for how long you should stop it. Stop prophylactic antiplatelet agents 5 to 10 days prior to surgery without bridging, and make sure cardiology signs off on acute bare metal stents or drug-eluting stents if you are stopping antiplatelet or dual platelet therapy. Thank you.